Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I want to start with just commentary about statistics and how misleading they can be and how difficult it is sometimes to understand numbers. And numbers lie, or they can. They can lie deliberately, or you can misunderstand what they mean. So just like when you sign a contract or a lease, it's really important to read the fine print. I'm going to give you some examples from some statistics that I found today on one of my favorite websites. I've been following the COVID pandemic primarily using the website of Le Monde, which is a French newspaper. I do that to brush up on my French. But also, I like the international perspective coming from a different country with, well, shall we say, different treating obligations and different priorities. I hear a lot about Africa because the French are still very, very engaged in what goes on in Africa. I think they have a little bit of colonizer's remorse. But anyway, so what we're talking about right now is their COVID site, and they have a really wonderful breakdown that I highly recommend you go check out. You can translate everything to English, but what they do is they give you the following statistics, and they update it daily, and they give you the number of deaths per country, the number of deaths per million population, and the evolution now. So is it going up? They'll have a positive and it'll be red. Is it going down? They'll have a negative sign. And by how much it's going down. So you probably heard that we're having a worldwide surge. There are 160,000 cases a day worldwide now. That's definitely an uptick. There are currently 10,475,826 people who have had COVID, 10 million in the world. There are 4 million who are still sick, 5,353 who've recovered, and 511,000 dead. And when it comes to dead, we're number one. And we're not alone. We're just big. So in the last 7 days, there's been a 32% increase in cases in the United States. There's been a 45% increase in Ireland, a 250% increase in Switzerland, and a 600% increase in Morocco. But Morocco only has 228 cases total. And so their death rate is 6.3 deaths per million. They're going to have their spike. They're just starting it. Deaths per million looks better. If we look at deaths per million, the U.S. is not number one. Spain is. 600 per million. And their rate of new cases is down by half. In other words, by 100% in the last 7 days. Down by half is a 100% decrease from where you start. And so that's half. France is down by 29%. The United States, as I said earlier, is up by 32%. And that's not news to you. You'd have to be living in a cave with all the electricity turned off not to have heard about that. Another useful thing that I'm recommending to my audience is our local UCSC CRAW lectures. That's K-R-A-W. UCSC has a YouTube site. You can go look at these lectures. I attended a really excellent one last night, and this one was giving a lot of information about epidemiology. And I'm just now trying to search for the name of the wonderful person who gave it, and see if I have that on any of the slides I photographed. But alas, I do not. So great apologies to the speaker. I am, however, going to share with you some of the really interesting information that is now pretty solid. And so this falls into the category of what we know today and what seems to be the major trend lines. Now, you all know how statistics work, right? The more cases you have, the more you tend to get a sort of hill-shaped plot, and with the average being right in the center of that hill. So we're going to work on our indication for viral shedding from your nose and mouth. And we're going to start with time equals zero. Time equals zero is your exposure. And 3 days after your exposure, if you've been successfully infected by the virus, you begin to shed virus. That's within only 3 days. At T equals 5 to 6, that is to say the fifth or sixth day after exposure, you are at peak shedding. And here's what it gets, where it gets really evil, folks. At day 6 to 7, you get the onset of your first symptoms. And around then, infectiousness begins to drop. So by the time you start to feel sick and have a runny nose or a sore throat or whatever you're going to get, body aches, fever, it's too late. You've already been infecting people for 3 days. By day 10, you are minimally infectious, but still not at zero. It's day 13 on the average when people start to have difficulty in breathing. And by the time you have difficulty in breathing, you probably already have testable IgG antibody at detectable levels. At day 15, you have no culturable virus. But the RNA from the nasal swab can still test positive for months. It's broken, dead, non-culturable, non-infectious RNA, but it's still going to give you a positive test. So how many people get infected? We talked about R-naught a few, gosh, it must have been about 6 weeks ago, explaining that that's the number of people that the average person who has the disease gives it. And at the time, they were estimating an R-naught based on a big block of data at about 3. It's come down some. It's at 2.5 now because people's behavior has changed. But that's not really how it actually works. One person doesn't affect 2.5. Observably, most people who get COVID don't spread to anyone. This is called, in epidemiologic terms, a stub. It's also used, that's a term that comes from family trees and the study of inheritance. There are people who shelter in place, self-isolate, and who were wearing a mask while asymptomatic because they were supposed to, and they did. And they don't give it to anybody. They get sick, they get well, they never affect others. I feel fine just doesn't cut it with COVID. If someone tells you that they feel fine, you can tell them from Dr. Don that they can feel fine for 3 days and be shedding virus all over the place. There was a very well-studied Austrian outbreak, very well-studied. And the people who did this study looked at about 41 cases, and they had contact tracing on all of them. Remember I mentioned the R naught, that's how many people you spread to? Well, 2 of the 41 spread to more than 10 people. One of them infected 9 people, and one of the 9 directly infected another 8, and one of those 8 infected another 4. A second one infected 14 people, and almost all of them sheltered in place and wore a mask and didn't infect anybody, but one of them went out and got 10 more people. So maybe these super spreader events are just, to a large extent, behavior. A lot of them have happened in churches where people sing and give each other the kiss of peace or a hug or a handshake. Super spreaders might just be friendly. They might be singers. they may be people who go to bars, get intoxicated, and hug strangers. Yeah. Where you go and what you do this coming weekend matters a lot. I cannot emphasize this enough. It is the 4th of July. I always throw a fireworks party. I am not going to do that. I'm not even going to go to the beach and watch other people's fireworks. I'm staying home. I don't like it, but I'm going to do it. If you don't wear a mask and distance, you won't get a citation. You won't get a ticket. You might even get, at the worst, a few dirty looks. But you could kill someone and never know it. Several someones, in fact. Going around right now without wearing a mask and not social distancing with people that you do not live with is exactly the equivalent of firing a rifle into the air at a rock concert. The bullet's going to go up. It's going to come down. When it comes down, it will have enough velocity to penetrate a skull and end a life. And you'll never know if you did. So please, behave yourself, especially now. Be a stub. Be a stub. Don't be a tree. I have an email that just came in, and we're going to move to that. And this one is, well, it's a cold read, guys. So I have some decay at the gum line in a couple of places, and my dentist suggested I use a prescription toothpaste with fluoride, or maybe just an over-the-counter toothpaste with a lower dose. I'm hesitant. I know there are some unwelcome effects of fluoride. Plus, many toothpastes have a bunch of stuff in them I don't want to put in my mouth. I do realize you're not a dentist, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on this. As always, many thanks. And this is from Pat in Santa Cruz. Well, yeah, fluoride. If a person has thyroid issues, or borderline hypothyroidism, fluoride can interfere with the absorption of iodine. And fluoride has, that's probably the biggest deal for an adult with fluoride. If you're already taking thyroid supplementation, it's a moot point. Or if your thyroid is good and your TSH is in the healthy range, it's probably not going to have any substantial effect on you. However, tooth decay is a big deal, and you got to get on top of your tooth decay. The fluoride is mainly helpful in children. I'm not certain how helpful it is for adults, but that's something you could easily check on at scholar.google.com and just put in fluoride in adults and see what pops up. You'll find some scientific articles. Nice thing I love, and I highly recommend this also, folks. If it's in scholar.google.com, it's peer-reviewed or it's a preprint. Right now, it's a preprint because we're putting a lot of stuff out there that's just, it's hot off the presses, and it hasn't been, as we've talked about, it hasn't been replicated or subjected to the same due diligence. Hence, Lancet publishing Didier Raoult's article on hydroxychloroquine, which if you go back and find my discussion of that article, I pointed out the problems statistically and numerically and conceptually with that article, which I'm going to be doing in just a few minutes with another email. So overall, I would say you're better off getting rid of the tooth decay, and then you can stop using fluoride. And if you want to take a little extra iodine, again, if you were not on a thyroid medication, if you are, you need to work with your doctor on that. You can, if you have a thyroid condition, you can get into trouble with iodine. In general, it takes doses above 10 milligrams. So what we put in vitamin supplements is nowhere near what it would take to do that. But you can buy stuff over the counter that could get you in trouble. Other things that I would recommend, there are some oral probiotics that are in lozenges that you're supposed to suck on that try to replace the bad probiotics with good ones. I am very fond of just taking peroxide on a Q-tip and rubbing it along the gum line where you have the tooth decay. Peroxide is uniformly toxic to bacteria, so you'll kill off a few of your good flora. But if you use a Q-tip and you target the areas of decay and then spit, you're probably going to be in good shape. I also want to point out that mechanically breaking up the areas of decay helps because you disrupt the biofilm. And that biofilm is like a coral reef that is dead, but it's got bacteria living in it. And it's very difficult to get into that coral reef with anything other than free radical oxygen species, which is exactly what you're delivering to the location when you use good old H2O2, highly reactive oxygen species. Unfortunately, you can't inhale it and you can't drink it. Well, you can a little bit, but I wouldn't recommend it. It's going to release a lot of irritation in the stomach if you do too much. Hope that helps. And just to remind you, you can email to onair@ksqd.org, or if you want to cut to the chase, just call me, 900-831-9573. So we're going to go to our first email. And this one was a very interesting one. This came from Shelley in Ohio. And I'm going to read the entire thing. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I have two questions. The first is about antioxidant supplements. It seems that there have been some research that shows taking antioxidant supplements may actually accelerate or promote the growth of some types of cancer. I've included a few links citing this information. While I've heard of this before related to beta carotene and lung cancer, the other information I've read recently talks about other types of cancer as well, including lung, skin, breast, and others. I know some of the typical antioxidant supplements are beta carotene, vitamin E, and vitamin C, but many other herbs and vitamins are high in antioxidants as well. This concerns me, and I'd like to get your opinion on taking some of the other supplements that are high in antioxidants. I do not take any of the typical antioxidant supplements I mentioned before, but I do take other supplements. What I take can change, and I've tried many supplements over the years. Currently, I'm taking magnesium citrate, vitamin D, lion's mane, and shiitake mushrooms. I also drink green tea and matcha tea. So my first question is, what is your opinion on the cancer risk associated with antioxidant supplements, and should all supplements that act as antioxidants be included in this list, meaning any herbs or vitamins, I should be concerned about taking those or not? My second question is about the lion's mane, shiitake, and other mushroom supplements. The research seems very promising on these. I started taking them for the cognitive and anti-depression, anti-anxiety benefits, and so far I've noticed a difference in how I feel, but these two contain antioxidants. I'm not worried about the antioxidants I get from my normal diet because I believe they are important in the normal amounts we get in our food, but they are much more concentrated and in much greater amounts in supplements. And what is your experience and opinion on the benefits of mushroom supplements? Thank you for your opinion and for all you do. I listen to your podcast and have learned so much from you. The information you provide is valuable to me. Well, thank you, Shelley. I hope it's valuable, and I intend to continue doing exactly what I do. So, and with modifications, if people have suggestions for how I can improve and I agree with them, I will take them. Now, benefits of mushroom supplements. There are tons of studies, mostly in the Japanese and other Asian literatures, that are well performed. I've reviewed those and talked about them over the years. It's hard to say that one mushroom is better than another. There is some data that suggests that after a while, the benefits of any particular mushroom begin to fade. So it's probably a good idea to rotate your mushrooms. And with some exceptions, I tend to rotate my supplements as well. And so I'm glad to see that you're doing that. So you can think of it as the body getting used to it, just like you stop hearing the ticking of a clock if you're in the room for long enough. I think mushrooms are very helpful. I also want to point out that there is some data that shows that they improve the type of immunity called T-cell immunity, that in particularly natural killer T-cells, which are the innate cells, the ones that we're all having, whether or not you have ever seen the virus before, and of course, none of us have. So improving your natural killer cells is a good way to bolt the door against the COVID, and we need all the help we can get with that one. So coming to your second question, you gave me three references, and I looked at those references, and they make the typical logical errors that I have seen in other studies. And I'm going to drill down a little bit on this because I think it's really important. So First of all, as part of my topic sentence, all of these studies used N-acetylcysteine and vitamin E, except for one. And that one was a review article in Scientific American that talked about beta carotene. So we'll come back to that one at the end. But let's start with a little background, okay? Reactive oxygen species damage DNA. That's why the hydrogen peroxide is so good at getting rid of your bacteria. It damages their DNA and they die. They can't reproduce. But you want to be careful where you put those reactive oxygen species because they also damage DNA. Antioxidants prevent this damage by effectively absorbing the reactive oxygen species like a sponge. They have effectively a molecular catcher's mitt for these little sizzling oxygen balls that are bouncing around, and if they go through your DNA, they're going to fry a piece of it. So there's ample evidence, as Shelley stated, that dietary food-based antioxidants reduce cancer incidence in populations. And that is exactly right. That is why a plant-based diet containing a minimum of 7 1/2 cup servings of fruits and vegetables is the best diet. And that one is not argued about. We talked about that 2 weeks ago in discussing some work that I learned about at the Functional Medicine Conference. Now, there's a huge logical, or it's not even, it's factual error in these papers. They all declare that NAC is an antioxidant. Look up, go ahead and Google, is an NAC an antioxidant? And Google will tell you it is not. It is a precursor to an antioxidant called glutathione. So you can have all the NAC that you want, but it's not going to do much unless you convert it to glutathione. And that takes special enzymes. And it's extremely important to understand that in none of these studies did they actually check glutathione levels to see whether or not it was in fact acting that the NAC was creating an antioxidant. They didn't look. They just assumed. And that's bad. The other problem is that the vitamin E that was used in all of these studies is equivalent to the industrial byproduct version of vitamin E, alpha-tocopherol. We know that alpha-tocopherol is actually a problem when you give it orally because it is not a cancer-fighting agent. It's not even a very good antioxidant. It is, however, kind of a pro-oxidant because it uses, basically it uses up your ability to absorb the good stuff. So the diet contains different kinds of vitamin E's. There's gamma and there's delta, and these appear to be the more powerful ones that actually are potent cellular antioxidants. The vitamin E that's used as a supplement is alpha, and I try to talk people out of using alpha-tocopherol because, indeed, there are some problems with it. It doesn't help with heart disease, whereas a diet high in vitamin E, like eat wheat germ, you know, a tablespoon of wheat germ will give you all the vitamin E you need, and it isn't alpha-tocopherol. So if you are going to try to get natural vitamin E and you're also taking a multivitamin, it's fine. Just make sure that you're natural, that you don't take the multivitamin when you eat your wheat germ, or it's going to interfere with the wheat germ working for you, and the wheat germ will work better. Of course, many people can't take wheat, and there you go. So there's lots of detail. Everything has to be contextual. Now, one of the articles that you sent me that was in Science and Translational Medicine 2014, January 29th, postulated the following. So I want you to work through the logic here with me, folks. These are artificially created tumors in mutant cloned mice, and they respond to industrial vitamin E and NAC in superphysiologic doses. And they claim that this protected DNA and reduced reactive oxygen species. Now, because reactive oxygen species and DNA damage, by the way, they didn't measure reactive oxygen species, just saying. So because reactive oxygen species and DNA damage were reduced in these mice that were artificially given cancer, what ordinarily happens to protect the cell? So when you have oxidative stress in a cell, that's dangerous. It damages DNA. So what you're going to do? You're going to call the cops. You're going to call for backup. And the name of the backup is P53. And what P53 does is it's a DNA inspector. It is going to basically look using its helpers. It's going to send out its minions. They are going to look at the DNA and they're going to find all the errors in the DNA. If there's too many errors, P53 is going to pull the plug on that cell. It is the thing that calls for, that the body uses to call for backup when a cell is threatened. P53 comes along and it's ready to just toast that cell, be the grim reaper for that cell if there's too much DNA damage. So P53 didn't go up in the experimental group, and therefore the tumors grew faster. And they went on to prove this concept by basically using some other mutant mice who had reduced P53 and showing that the cancer grew faster in them. So, okay, logical fallacies here. Let's start with dosing, okay? A lot of times when I read these studies, the problem is that the doses that they're using are supraphysiologic. In other words, way more than can work. So in the case of the NAC, they gave very big doses of NAC, the equivalent essentially of you eating an entire bottle of NAC every day. Now, typically what happens is when you give the body too much of something, it shuts down the use of that something. And that's like, for example, if you take too much thyroid hormone, your own brain stops sending signal to your thyroid to make thyroid hormone because you've got too much. Well, the body has all sorts of these. So when you give massive doses of something, sometimes you get the opposite effect to what the right dose would do. And what's the right dose here? Well, in the case of N-acetylcysteine, it's probably, you know, in humans, 400 milligrams. If you give 100 milligrams to a mouse that doesn't even weigh a kilogram, whereas you weigh 60, it's not going to work the same way. They also gave massive overdoses of the vitamin E, the wrong vitamin E, and they gave massive overdoses of it. So if you do the calculation, the recommended daily amount for alpha-tocopherol, and that is, in fact, you know, when you look on the back of your vitamin pills, that's probably what you're taking, but it's about 800 international units in that, and that's in, let's call it a 70 kilogram individual. Okay, so that works out to 7 milligrams per kilogram in the human. Now, the mice got a range, but they goosed the feed so much that the mice got something on the order of 60 milligrams per kilogram, almost 10 times the amount. And that's just not going to work the same way. NACTA is not an antioxidant. It's used to make glutathione, and that's the antioxidant. So if you want to figure out what's going on, check the antioxidant level. There was one here about melanoma. And it was, well, you know, we gave lots of NAC and the melanoma, there were more melanomas and they spread differently. And yeah, you affected physiology in your mice, but not in, it's not generalizable. And that's the thing. You can't generalize in mutant cloned mice given artificial tumors to even wild type mice, you know, who grow real mouse tumors, let alone wild type humans. And, you know, there's a fairly substantial difference between humans and mice physiologically. I don't even know how mice make glutathione, or they probably make it, but I don't know at what dose they stop making it because you gave them too much precursor. Now, the beta carotene study goes all the way back to 1996. And you hear this all the time. Don't take antioxidants because they cause cancer. Or they make cancer worse. This was a study of people with cancer who had been treated for cancer. So they already have the disease. And the question is, how long did they live? did they die sooner? Did they get more recurrences? So some of these people were non-smokers. Some of them were smokers. Some of them got placebo. Some of them got beta carotene. Some of them quit smoking after their cancer, and some of them didn't and continued to smoke. So there's one group that got more progression of their cancers when they were on beta carotene. And that was the group that took the beta carotene and continued to smoke. So the quitters had reduced reactive oxygen species. They had less DNA damage. So any residual cancer mutates more slowly. And it's in this cancer's mutation that fools the immune system that allows cancers to come back and reestablish. Cancer surgery doesn't remove every single cell of any cancer. It debulks it such that what remains is small enough for the immune system to kill. There are always circulating cancer cells retrievable from the bloodstream with any solid tumor, always. Maybe these cancers, and this is at the time when the cancer is discovered, they're circulating cancer cells, you can find them. Maybe these cancers try to take root, but the odds are very much against them. Just like go take some California poppy seeds and throw them up in the middle of the air in the parking lot. Asphalt. Maybe if there's a crack in the asphalt and you do it at the right time of year and there's enough rain, you'll get a poppy plant growing. But most of those seeds are just going to get eaten by birds. And that's, in the case of the immune system, most of those cells get eaten by your immune system. The immune cells have their description. Remember how I said that they said that reactive oxygen species raise the level of protective P53? Well, smokers who continued to smoke and took beta carotene didn't raise P53. That may be a factor. But also, and I think this is more important, smoking caused tumors to mutate. Cigarette smoke's a mutagen. If you get mutation, then some of those cells are going to mutate away from the pattern that your immune system has learned to recognize. And the proof of this is that the quitters who took beta carotene did better than the ones on placebo. So you see, this is nuanced. It's contextual. And you can't take the study and do a blanket, oh, well, antioxidants increase the growth rate of cancer. So the studies that you showed me had serious logical flaws, and I think need to be thrown out the window. I believe that in the situation where you have had a cancer and that it has been debulked, that taking antioxidants is probably going to reduce further mutation of any proto-cancers that got left behind, and therefore you will do better. And of course, it's a race between your immune system and the cells, but for the most part, fewer mutations is better. Now, I want, while we're talking about antioxidants, to mention the paradox. I've already talked about the paradox. Too much does the opposite of what you expect. So let's talk for just a moment about vitamin C. And this is not done, probably should be done. And if I ever have to get chemotherapy, I am definitely going to do it for myself. And here's how it works. When you take chemotherapy, and that drug is circulating in your body, there's a couple of things you can do to make it work better. And one of them is to fast. If you have fasted before the therapy or have eaten a reduced calorie diet, you will put your normal healthy cells into hibernation. They will not be dividing quickly. They'll be kind of, they're like, okay, let's just chill and wait this out. We're not going to divide. There's no fuel. We're going to wait. Cancer cells can't turn their growth off. That's mutated away. That's why they're cancer cells. So the cancer cells are still out there dividing, and it's during division that the cells are at their most vulnerable. This is one of the good things you can do. The second good thing you can do, if you can manage to make it work, is IV vitamin C. And if you give enough intravenous vitamin C, and I'm talking like 17, 18 grams of vitamin C, that's a lot of vitamin C. But if you do that, you get something called an oxidative burst. It actually increases free radicals. It's a reaction to such high doses of vitamin C. It basically causes oxidative stress and increases the damage done by the chemo to the cancer cells. It does this in a way that is not dangerous to your own cells, particularly if you're also fasting. There isn't as much chemo. You don't have to use as high a dose. You get more toxicity, and the vitamin C itself is harmless. It's just that the oxidative burst that it creates, also harmless, except when there's chemotherapy drugs around, augments the effect of the chemo. Now, this is old data. There's good papers on it. It was hacked by the man. It was hacked by the establishment that doesn't like these things. And I know I'm sounding like a conspiracy theorist, but the main study that quote-unquote refuted the vitamin C hypothesis was done at Johns Hopkins back in the 80s. And what they did was they gave high-dose, maximum-tolerated oral vitamin C, and it didn't work. Well, it wouldn't, because you have to get a fast burst in the bloodstream, and you can't do that orally. The digestive tract is designed not to let large amounts of things flood into your system. They knew that. By designing the study to use equivalent doses of oral vitamin C, what they ended up doing was giving everybody diarrhea and not helping them. Was that deliberate? Sometimes I think so. I'm not sure whether, you know, you get a better grant from whoever's funding grants this year to prove that antioxidants don't work or shouldn't be used in cancer. But these studies really don't prove that. This is Phyllis in Illinois. And Phyllis writes, Dear Dr. Don, what brand do you recommend for a green tea lotion? I'm reading How Not to Die by Dr. Greger, and he recommends drinking black, green, or white tea, and he also suggests a green tea lotion. I'm a fan of the, by the way, I am a fan of black tea for taste, but I have developed a taste for green tea, and I like it cold. It's perfect for iced tea with a little lemon, and it is very, very good antioxidant. In fact, 4 cups of green tea per day actually will reduce oxidative stress. It's a potent antioxidant and an anti-inflammatory, and get this, it's been shown to interfere with the reproduction of COVID, or rather EGCG, epigallocatechin gallate. I've finally remembered how to say it. It's an ingredient in green tea, highly antioxidant, highly anti-cancer, and also really good for topical cancer prevention and skin aging, photo aging. So lots of studies backing this up. You're right, Phyllis. And so is Dr. Greger. I found one article that was pretty good looking at acne. It showed that a 2% worked for acne. But when I looked at the photo aging and extrapolated, the photo aging creams were quite a bit stronger than that, you know, on the order of 15 to 20%. So you're going to want to find the most concentrated cream that you can. And when I researched this, I wasn't able, the time that I had, to find the ingredients. You're going to have to write to the companies. At least Amazon, where I looked, wasn't showing the back side of this. And since they're combinations of things, you're looking for the highest percentage of EGCG you can get. And unfortunately, you don't get any systemic benefit from this. It's not like, let's say, putting topical testosterone or topical estrogen on your skin and getting a blood level. You're going to find that the EGCG gets broken down in the skin by the enzymes in the skin, so it doesn't get into the bloodstream. So effectively, the worst thing that you could do, no matter how concentrated you get, is have a rash, and that would probably be to one of the other ingredients. So the dose that was used is close to 50% in the anti-cancer. So just saying, it may be a little tricky to find a strong enough one, get the strongest one you can, and I'm not going to suggest brands because I didn't have time to do so. Okay, I think we had gotten through Phyllis. Now we're on to another email, and let me check the time. Oh my goodness, it's 4 minutes. Okay, Rebecca in Sunnyvale. We're going to go real quick with this. She wants to know about blood type. Does blood type influence your approach to medical care, such as surveillance for certain conditions or intensity of treatments or lifestyle recommendations? Does knowing my blood type give me any actionable information if I don't need a transfusion? I've seen advertisements for blood type diets or exercise program. Not confident in the data. You're right, Rebecca. It's garbage data. that the blood type does not affect your, I've never seen convincing studies on that. So I don't think that is. However, I did see convincing studies on COVID that just came out recently about, well, maybe 3 months ago. The first studies came out of Wuhan. And what they showed us was a trend or a tendency towards increased cases of COVID in people who were type A. Then secondly, that's been studied again. And there was a paper that just came out. It's in preprint from New York Presbyterian. So I like that it's in Americans or, you know, Europeans. In other words, it's not the same group. So it's not just a genetic thing. And they found the same thing. Type A positive blood puts you at increased risk for COVID. Type O makes you safe. And they don't have data on type B and type AB because those are smaller groups. So the data is less significant. I read a third article. This one was in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. And they basically said something that made a heck of a lot of sense. People with type O blood they have more IL-6, and they have a different amount of ACE, the angiotensin converting enzyme, in their system. They actually have less of it, so they have relatively more ACE2 activity, and they may actually, so they basically have more anti-inflammatory activity, and it's the inflammation that puts you in the hospital. They may also have fewer receptors for ACE2. It's on their cells, and there is some evidence that there may be variations in different racial groups on that. So, hacking through the weeds here in the world of science, it's Dr. Dawn. Thank you so much for listening. So long, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.